Many times I have shown this picture in many of my talks. Pearl derives from many sources. These are probably the four biggest ones. You should not take this picture to mean that linguistics is the opposite of common sense. There are many computer scientists who have complained that it should be more like engineering and less like an art, and I disagree, but that's okay. But Pearl also draws ideas from many other sciences, ecology, math, sociology, etc., etc., etc. I have given talks about those too, but I'm not going to do that today. Also draws ideas from the science of golf. The biology of Pearl, there's lots of different aspects of that that have Pearl has borrowed metaphors from, which we could also talk about. And you can feel free to ask me about any of these things later. You know what the Harvard Law is? That says under controlled conditions of water, temperature, light, food, the organism will do as it damn well pleases. In speaking of paleontology, I dug up this fossil. It's kind of a dinosaur egg. When Pearl was first starting out, this was how people saw the universe. If you were a Unix programmer, you either programmed in C or shell. There really wasn't much in between. There were these little languages that you used on top of shell, but that was the big divide. The big revelation that hatched Pearl, as it were, was that this opened up into a two-dimensional space. And C was good at something I like to call manipulexity, that is the manipulation of complex things. While shell was good at something else, which I call whipuptitude, the aptitude for whipping things up. Pearl was hatched as a small egg, and that was Pearl 1. But it was designed from the very beginning to evolve. The fact that we put sigils on the front of the variables meant that the namespaces were protected from new keywords. And that was intentional, so we could develop the language very rapidly without impacting. And it evolved. And finally we got to Pearl 5. Perhaps the Pearl 6 slogan should be, all your paradigms are belong to us. But we'll get to that. Well, we had these five successful organisms. This is this ongoing... if you look at the Pearl culture right now, it's very healthy, very vibrant, lots of stuff going on. Nobody can keep track of it all. Why? There are evolutionary reasons and psychological reasons, linguistic reasons, anthropological reasons, and of course, sometimes there's just no good reason. So I like to start off with my own irrationalities. I don't think syntax should dangle in the wind. I'm with Aristotle. I think things should have a beginning, a middle, and an end, which means I like KNR bracketing. I do not like the way Python hangs stuff out there with no end. I think that ordinary people dislike abstraction. That's because I dislike abstraction, and I think I'm ordinary. I might be wrong about that, but I don't know. I simultaneously believe that languages are wonderful and awful. You have to hold both of those. Ugly things can be beautiful, and beautiful can get ugly very fast. You know, take Lisp. It's the most beautiful language in the world, at least up until Haskell came along. Every programmer in Lisp is just ugly. I don't figure how that works. I think visual metaphors are very important. How it looks, different things should look different. Similar things should look similar. A language designer simultaneously has to care what other people think and has to not care what other people think. Otherwise, you go crazy. well, crazier. And finally, I think God has free will, and therefore he created programmers with free will, and that they ought to be given choices. Now, I'm not the only language designer with irrationalities. You can think of some languages to go with some of these things. Excuse me. We need to start over from scratch. That's almost any academic language you find. English phrases, that's COBOL, you know, cargo cult English. Text processing doesn't matter much, Fortran. Simple languages produce simple solutions, C. If I wanted it fast, I'd write it in C. That's almost a direct quote from the original awk page. I thought of a way to do it, so it must be right. That's obviously PHP. You can build anything with NAND gates. Any language designed by an electrical engineer will. This is a very high-level language. Who cares about bits? The entire scope of fourth-generation languages fell into this problem. Users care about elegance. A lot of languages from Europe tend to fall into this. Eiffel. The specification is good enough. Ada. Abstraction equals usability. Scheme. Things like that. The common kernel should be as small as possible. Fourth. Let's make this easy for the computer. Lisp. Most programs are designed top-down. Pascal. Everything is a vector. APL. Everything is an object. Small talk and its children. Ruby. Everything is a hypothesis. Prologue. Everything is a function. Haskell. Programmers should never have been given free will. Obviously, Python. So my psychological conjecture is that normal people, if they perceive that a computer language is forcing them to learn theory, they won't like it. In other words, hide the fancy stuff. It can be there, just hide it. Going from psychology to linguistics, I think that Perl succeeds primarily because it does behave like a natural language. Some of the things that the underlying deep principles, rather than cargo culting in phrases like COBOL did, we try to aim for deep principles of linguistics. With a natural language, you learn it as you go, and you learn it once and use it many times. So you should optimize for expressiveness, not for ease of learnability. Learnability is okay, but expressiveness is more important. Competence, we do not expect a 50-year-old to speak with the same level of confidence as a 5-year-old, and that's okay. You can use talk baby talk. There's multiple ways to say the same thing. There's no shame in borrowing words, unless you're French. Fractal dimensionality. When you saying something linguistically is like taking a trip. When you take a trip from California to Netanya, you don't go straight south and then straight west and then straight north. It's not orthogonal. There's little bits at the beginning, and then you take bigger hops on the plains, and you take littler hops at the end. Language works the same way. It's fractal. There's little orthogonality, at least apparently. You can have orthogonal views of it. There are orthogonal subsets, but there are multiple orthogonal subsets. And at first glance, it just looks like a network, and you have to navigate the geography. More natural language things, which we'll probably skip over most of them, but they have corresponding things in Perl. Natural language develops without an overriding theory. Your peers enforce the style. The language does not enforce your style. Design is distributed. Dialects will diverge, so you should plan for it. It's useful to take things from multiple languages and jammed them all into one language. You may have noticed some of that in Perl. And finally, a language without a culture is dead. It's not just an intellectual exercise to design a language. You have to have the culture to go with it. And which leads us to my anthropology ideas, which is Perl culture is just as important to the success of Perl as the language itself, because the culture can fix the language, but not vice versa. Now, in terms of anthropology, we try to be, welcome people into the tribe. We allow people to have their own little fiefdoms where they are the ruler and can beat up on their followers. We try to let people share with each other, and we try to capture knowledge. Both of those things are why we have the CPAN, Comprehensive Perl Archive Network, which is arguably one of the greatest repositories of reusable crappy software in the world. And we have a culture of cooperating with other cultures too. We're trying to make Parrot so that other languages can run on top of it. We've always tried to hook up Perl with everything in kind of a humble sort of a way. But finally, it's a culture of fun. At least we try to make it that way. And that's why I give weird talks. Well, what about the hard sciences? There's physics, especially quantum physics. That's pretty hard. Chemistry might be a hard science if you think of it as physics. But we're not so sure. Golf is pretty hard, though. Now, I've often shown this this waterfall chart, and many of you have probably seen it. If you turn it into a fractal feedback loop, and if you run it the other direction, then you have extreme programming. But the point is, you're racing around like this in this strange attractor of some sort or other. But how do you know when you're done? Other than the tests tell you you're done, but are the tests right? Who knows? Well, we all who have studied science have seen these potential energy curves. Now, if you're an economist, you turn this upside down, you have hill climbing algorithms, but it's just the same thing. The ball wants to roll downhill. Are we optimal? No. Is it optimal now? Maybe. Maybe not. We could be in a false minimum. Now, we're happy where we are, but we don't yet know that we might be happier over there. It takes a certain amount of energy to climb over the hill and take a peek. And, that's... you can do it that way, or you can find sneaky ways to get through. Arguably, this is the Parrot approach, and this is the Pug's approach. But however you get there, it's the Promised Land. I think you guys know something about the Promised Land. if you go back here, here's Jacob and Caleb wanting to sneak into the land, and here's the children of Israel wanting to spend 40 years in the desert. But, hopefully we can get Perl 6 out in less than 40 years. But if that's how long it takes, we're still going to get there. Dear Larry, I love Perl. It has saved my company, my career, my sanity, and my marriage. After Perl, I can't imagine going back to any other language. I dream of Perl. I tell everyone else about Perl. How can you improve on perfection? Signed, Happy in Haifa. Dear Happy, you need to recognize that Perl can be as good in some dimensions and not so good in other dimensions. You also need to recognize that there will be some pain in climbing over or tunneling through the barrier to the true minimum. Now, Perl 5 has a few false minima in syntax, semantics, pragmatics, discourse structure, implementation, documentation, culture. Other than that, Perl 5 is not too bad. Dear Larry, you've often talked about the waterbed theory of linguistic complexity, and beauty times brains equals a constant. Isn't it true that improving Perl in some areas will automatically make it worse in other areas? Signed, Terrified in Tel Aviv. Dear Terrified. No. You see, you can make some things so that they aren't any worse. For instance, we changed all the sigils to be more consistent, and they're just the same length. They're just different. And you can make some things much better. Instead of having to write all this gobbledygook to dereference references in Perl 5, you can just do it straight left to right in Perl 6. Or there's even more, a few more shortcuts, so constant, but multiple-dimensional arrays and constant hash subscripts get their own notation, so it's even clearer, at least once you've learned it. Again, we're optimizing for expressiveness, not necessarily learnability. Dear Larry, I've heard a disturbing rumor that Perl 6 is turning to Java or Python or Ruby or something. What's the point of using Perl if it's just another object-oriented language? Why are we changing the arrow operator to the dot operator? Mind. Nervous. And Natanya. They're nervous. First of all, we can do object orientation better without making other things worse, as I said. And we're changing from arrow to dot because... Well, just because I said so. Well, actually, we do have some good reasons. It's shorter. It's the industry standard. I wanted the arrow for something else, and I wanted the dot as a secondary sigil, so we could have it for attributes that have accessors. I also wanted the unary dot for topical type calls with an assumed object on the left. And finally, because I said so. Darn it. So let's go from the present continuous imperfect though it may be, to the future perfect, or at least perfecter. Now, when we started off this Perl 6 adventure, we said, we announced the community is going to rewrite Perl 6. It's going to rewrite the language, the culture, the development, everything. So we opened it up, and I expected maybe 20 RFCs. For changes, we got 361. And they were all over the map. They contradicted each other. They had some really bogus solutions, and they all suffered from the same problem, which is they each of them assumed that this was the only change you were going to make to Perl 5. And, you know, otherwise everything else would be the same. Well, that's not how you do a redesign. If you do a redesign that way, you end up with a mishmash. So one of the things I discovered, for instance, is that the first law of language design is that everyone wants the colon for their particular syntax. And they can't all have it because it's contradictory. So the second law of language redesign is Larry gets the colon for whatever he wants. I had to take a Winnie the Pooh approach. This was just way too much information for one person. You know, even somebody as smart as Audrey could not comprehend all of this at once. And I'm stupider than Audrey, at least in some ways. So I took the ways in which I am stupid as a sort of a model of what Perl programmers like. So I figured if I can understand something very easily, it probably wouldn't be very understandable to anybody else. So I would be very careful about introducing that sort of a feature. We call it the bear of very little brain approach. And it works for me because that's the only thing I can do. Right at the beginning, we said there's never time to do it right, but there's always time to do it over. So we're just going to take the time to do it right. You've heard the saying, good, fast, cheap, pick two. Well, this is open source. We have to do it cheap. Therefore, it reduces to a problem of good or fast, pick one. We chose good. We did not choose fast. You may have noticed this, considering we announced Perl 6 5.5 years ago. We're still going to do it right. And it's as long as it is a convergent process, we'll get there. It's really simple. You just keep everything good and throw out everything bad. That's easier said than done. So our goals, which we'll cover in the rest of our time here, simplification, power, object orientation, functional programming, pattern matching, iterative programming, lots of buzzword compatibility. But behind those are some meta goals. Pick good defaults, but allow for evolution. We found out the problem with Perl 5, it allowed for evolution. It put object orientation completely orthogonally, I'm an English speaker and I can't even say the word, into the language. It's wonderfully orthogonal, but it's too orthogonal because it doesn't set up any good defaults and everyone does it differently and nothing can interoperate. So Perl 6 will pick a good default object-oriented way to do things, but allow for evolution. Declarative multiculturalism. Multiculturalism, this is a very sort of postmodern idea. Multiculturalism is great as long as you know that it's if you're in a multicultural situation. Perl 6 is not going to be a single language. You start off in standard Perl 6 at the top, and every time you say use or declare a macro or something, you're changing into a different language, a different culture. As long as you declare it, all is fair if you pre-declare. Context dependency, I don't really have time to explain that. Better encapsulation, but also excapsulation. You shouldn't have to worry about the innards of a module, but there are ways in which the innards of a module shouldn't have to worry about the outside world, unless it wants to. So, and not just modules, but any kind of scoping mechanism, any kind of lexical scope, package scope. There's lots of different scopes. Different ways to isolate the things dimensionally. Dwimmery, when that's do what I mean for me. When we design a dwimming feature in Perl 6, we try to put it in one spot and then reuse it everywhere, so you don't have to, you know where which table to look up to find out, for instance, how the smart match operator works. No arbitrary limits, round two. Perl started off with the idea strings should grow infinitely if you have memory, and just let's get rid of those arbitrary limits that plagued Unix utilities in the early years. Perl 6 is taking this in a number of different dimensions than just how long your strings are. No arbitrary limits. You ought to be able to program very abstractly. You ought to be able to program very concretely. That's just one dimension. Behind that, there's another yet more meta goal, and that is we want to manage complexity in the future so that you people who are interested in changing Perl to do what you want can do that. And there's a meta goal, which is, of course, to enjoy life. Now, when you're young, enjoy life means I enjoy life. When you start getting a little older like me, you start in the way you enjoy life is by helping other people enjoy life. And there's a balance in there. But, so let's un-meta-meta-meta. Which, of course, means we're back to bike shed painting here. So all of you people who are not interested in Perl at all can go to sleep now. I don't hear any snoring. Okay. I caught a cold before I came, so this is an American cold, not an Israeli cold. Don't worry about that. We made many simplifications, which we will go through here. In Perl 5, it started off without nested data structures because it was just a scripting language. So we sort of waved our hands and rationalized how these weird sigils work, but they were inconsistent. We've made them consistent. If it's an array, it always has an add on the front. If it's a hash, it always has a percent, regardless of how you use it. And this gives us referential transparency. We've also, by the way, I mentioned the constant subscripts. We've stolen angle brackets for constant subscripts. So they're very visually distinct. Rather than having a weird rule that if you have a bare word inside curlies, we now give it a separate construct. And there's just lots of ways in which this clarifies your intent. So inside curlies is now always an expression. No special rules. We're trying to get rid of all these special rules. A my variable in Perl 5 extends to the end of its closing block, except that if a my variable is declared in a closed structure, or it only extends the end, and no further sometimes. My eyes glaze over. If I were Damien, I would put gibberish in there. In Perl 6, the rules are a little bit simpler. It extends the end of enclosing block and no further. Rule 2, there is no rule 2. There's no more double parsing. Perl 5 was always looking for the end of the string and then trying to figure out what was in the string, which is a mistake. So there's no problem with having an expression containing quotes inside a double quote string, even though they're the same kind of quote. It knows what it's looking for at that particular time. Now, in Perl 5 would blow up on this pattern. The reason it would blow up on it, actually, it should probably have a slash x on the end, leaving that aside, okay, how many of you can see it, the problem there? Oops. See the slash gets matched. Well, maybe you can't see it. No, you really can't see it. The slash in the comment there matches the beginning slash. So Perl 5 thinks that's the end of the regular expression and gets very confused. That's fixed in Perl 6 because of this one-pass parsing. When you're in a comment, it knows it's in a comment. Simpler precedence. We reduce the number of precedence levels a little bit by one or two. It's for like went from 24 to 22 or something. There are fewer gotchas. You know, C, you had to put parens some places you didn't expect to. We had to unify the relational and equality precedence levels so that we could do chained equality operators the way mathematicians like to do. Perl 5 is just all full of these strange gobbledygooky variables, which we all know and love and hate. So there's the error variables are now unified into a single error variable. These variables that have been deprecated forever, they're gone. These weird things that just drive syntax highlighters nuts now actually have more regular names. The star there, dollar star GID, that's what we call a secondary sigil. What that just says is this is in the global namespace. We know that that's a global variable for the entire process. Similarly for UIDs, a lot of these things ought to have been object properties of some object or other, such as a file handle. And that it has a global name. And there was this, in Perl 5, there was this list of names that just magically was the same variable in every package. And you had to memorize that. You don't have to memorize that anymore because we have the star notation, which says which things are globals. You can leave the star out, and it will find the global one anyway, but you don't have to keep track of it. Likewise, standard in is and his friends were these mysterious everywhere variables, and we even managed to shorten them to while we were making them more regular. Now, people are always saying, you know, I program in C, and I like to be able to leave the curlies off of my expression. Why can't we make the curlies optional? And that's always gone back to my irrationality of not liking dangling syntax. But I'm kind of glad now that I never made those optional because it turns out that if you keep the curlies mandatory, you can make the parentheses optional on the expressions, and the. It removes a lot of the visual clutter, makes it less like Lisp. And those blocks, because the curlies are still mandatory around a block, those blocks are all now, logically, closures, especially if they use lexical variables outside, as this closure does. That's how you write in Perl 5, but in Perl 6, you don't have to say the sub. Any block that's like this is just automatically a closure, unless it's a hash constructor. But now another regularization was in C and Perl and many C-derived languages. You don't know which blocks require a semicolon on the end and which ones do require a semicolon on the end. You just have to memorize it. Or just put semicolons everywhere and then people think you're stupid. In Perl 6, we've regularized that. Any line-ending curly it has an implicit semicolon on the end, so you just don't have to worry about it. Things which were special cases in Perl 5 now just naturally fall out of these rules. Gaul likes the moose. Yes. Now this is just a little bit different. The comma there is now required after the curly, or it would think it was the end of the list. But that's a small price to pay for the regularization that we now have. Likewise, map was a special case in Perl 5. It is not a special case. Sort was a special syntactic case. And instead of $A and $B being magical variables that you should avoid, we now have a placeholder syntax that works just the same, only it's generalized. And it just says, we have two parameters to this closure. They happen to be named A and B, and they will be passed in that order. And we always get the question saying, well, but what if it gets too complicated? How will I keep track of the alphabetical order? That's not what it's for. If it gets that complicated, you should use a regular parameter list. So when you see something like a for loop, which is like for each in Perl, that actually is logically a closure, a subroutine on the end there. It has an implicit parameter, dollar underscore. So it still works just the same way as you think of in Perl 5. But you could pass an explicit, using one of these explicit placeholder variables, that means exactly the same thing. I have one parameter, print it. Or we have another notation, which we call the pointy sub, which is another way of declaring a block with parameters. Now, if you know Ruby, then it puts the parameter names inside vertical bars. I didn't like that. I like the way this reads, because you say the for list and then just bind it to this formal parameter to that block and print it. It's a lambda. Okay? It's just sort of on its side or something. So because we're just binding to a formal parameter list, it's just like you passed a sub as the last argument, only it reads a lot nicer. And because it's a formal parameter list, you can have more than one parameter. We can have two parameters, so it takes the list two at a time, or three at a time. No, the next slide's not four at a time. You can take two arrays in parallel, and that this each and the semicolon there is a way of piping two arrays into a single construct. And there are piping constructs, which I don't have time to talk about, but that's essentially a multi-dimensional list. It knows to take that in parallel, so this allows you to read two arrays in parallel. But on the other hand, that looks a little bit, with the semicolons in there, a little bit like C's for loop, if you ignore the each. But there's a little confusion there. So instead of using for, which is or left over from C, we've changed that keyword to loop. But the three arguments still work the same way as they do in C, so you still have the generalized loop. But having a different keyword is great there, because we can then just get rid of... we had this funny idiom for an infinite loop in Perl 5. We got it from C. In Perl 6, you just say loop. navigate. Now, this would be like the control loop for a cruise missile. And when we speak of bombing out of the loop, we mean it literally. Perl 5 had this problem with do loops because they weren't real loops. They were a do block followed by a statement modifier, and people kept wanting to use loop control in it. Well, we can fix that. Loop now is a real loop, and it allows a modifier on it, but still behaves as a real loop. And so do goes off to have other duties, and you can write a loop that, that tests at the end, and it is a real loop. And so this is just one of many, many, many things that confused Perl 5 new programmers. And if you go and visit Perl Monks and read through all the questions that people ask, you know, about 9 out of 10 of them, we don't because people would get very tired of it. People already get tired of our hyping Perl 6. You could go through about 9 out of 10 of those and say, this is going to be fixed in Perl 6. This situation won't arise in Perl 6. We've regularized that, you know. And yet it's still Perl. It's just, it's Perl underneath. It's got a different syntactic sugar on the top. Got rid of type globs. Instead of using type globs for aliasing, we have a new mystery operator, which I'll get to later, and there it is on the second line. Wow, that was quick. We'll talk about not only the simplifications, but these new powerful things, and we can only cover a few of them. We get full type signatures now on variables, on in parameter lists, and they behave just as you would expect them to, presuming you know what to expect. There's also some lowercase ones, which are native types rather than object types. We distinguish uppercase just by convention. Uppercase types are object-oriented types, whereas if I say my int array, I mean a packed array of ints, or a packed bit array. So we can now talk about, optionally, very compact storage. And the VM is free to optimize this greatly. So we have the capacity of doing some things and using a lot less memory than Perl 5 does. So these types are very useful, particularly with arrays that can be packed. Now, Perl 5, another place where it was too orthogonal, was we defined parameter passing to just come in as an array. It's just, arrays, subroutines. They're just orthogonal. You just happen to have one called at underscore, which your arguments come in. And it was wonderfully orthogonal, and people built all sorts of stuff on top of it, and it's another place where we are changing. So instead of having these weird prototype pills, and you call it like this, in Perl 6, you can just say, I'm expecting an array as the first argument, and then put the rest of the arguments into this what we call a slurpy array, because it slurps up the rest of the arguments. So 1, 2, and 3 end up in at args, and because we don't enclose that up there. Now, that's all well and good as its own thing, but, you know, We like to unify these things. I said these RFCs propose many different solutions. The hard design goal is to find the unifying concepts underneath all of these RFCs and try to treat the underlying diseases rather than the symptoms. So we've unified argument passing, which is a form of binding, with an operator, which is an aliasing operator, which does binding, spelled colon equals. And that does exactly the same thing as passing that list into that argument list. There's no copying involved. It just is just changing the names. And so you can swap two names on things if you want. We've left equals completely untouched because we think Perl 5 programmers would rise up in revolt if we changed that. Another powerful thing is a thing called hyperoperators. You know, if you add two arrays together in Perl 5, what do you get? Well, you end up with the lengths of the two arrays added. Well, guess what? It does that in Perl 6 by default, because it still makes the scalar list context distinction. I was a little smarter about that. However, you can explicitly say, I want to do these in parallel. What I really mean by that plus is add each element of A to the corresponding element of B and produce a new list. And for those explicit parallel operations, we have what we call the hyperoperator. It's a meta operator, like assignment operators and similar things, which modifies that operator to do a different operation. So not only can you do that, but you can have a scalar on one side. It's a little bit smart. So it just says add one to each element of add A and return that. Or you can do it in place. Just increment each element of A. Or you can even write it. How do you type it? With your keyboard. Do you use VI or Emacs? In VI, it's Control K > It's not hard, and people will figure it out. You can also write it with two regular greater thans, or two less than. Everything we're getting into the age of Unicode, and we want to make Unicode programming possible. But so we're trying to shove people a little bit in that direction. So the actual operators that we're encouraging you to use are actually all in the Latin 1 range. So this is in the Latin 1 range. But everything has an ASCII workaround that is Unicode. So it's not a big problem. Likewise, if you turn them inside out, the French quotient, and again, you can use the regular angle brackets. And yes, we did change here docs, so that does not conflict. Then that's the equivalent of a QW. Only this QW interpolates. If you use single angles, it does not interpolate. That is an exact QW. How are we doing here? Okay. We have properties that you can put on variables and onto values. These are generalizations of things that were special in special code in Perl 5, but now we have general mechanisms to do the same things. They're actually done just with a mix-in mechanism like Ruby. Smart match operator is one of these very... it's like... What does Damien say? It's equal tilde on steroids. Instead of just allowing a regular expression on the right side, it allows basically anything. And it figures out that this wants to do a numeric comparison, this wants to do a string comparison, this wants to compare two arrays, this wants to do a lookup in the hash, this wants to call the closure on the right, passing in the left argument, and it will tell you if $x can quack. Now that might look a little strange because you could just say $x dot can quack. Why would you do it this way? Well, you'll see. You can match against classes. That tells you whether this is a mammal or whether it does the mammal interface. And another thing is against junctions. If any of you have seen Damien's quantum superpositions, this is just his any of 1, 2, or 3. But we stole the short bit operator operations because we think in Perl people don't actually use 2-bit operations that often. They now have something, they're regularized a different way. But now you can write this, and that just means if X matches any of 1 or 2 or 3. And that's... Junctions are not just used for smart operations, but they can be used anywhere. Now, another thing that we've done is people have always wanted a switch statement, and so we now have a switch statement, but it's instead of saying switch and case, which is talking about the constructs, we do it more like a natural language where we actually have words that sound like you'd say it in English. Well, given one of these, when it's one or two or three, then argle, and when it's A or B, then bargle, etc. Yes. No. It breaks by default. You would actually, if you want to fall through to the next test, you would say continue. And if you want to go into the body of the next test, as is the default in C, then you'd actually have to do go to. We try to discourage that. But you don't have to say case, and all those fall through to one thing, because we have these junctional things. And these are all what we call topicalizers. And that's another natural linguistic thing. But this is unified with the tilde-tilde operator. The smart match operator is the same semantics under here. That's where we said we try to unify things. So a topicalizer is anything that sets dollar underscore. So when you're looping through an array here, each element is set to dollar underscore, and when is just doing a smart match against that. And by the way, dollar underscore is a lexical variable in Perl 6. Methods can topicalize if you set the invocant to dollar underscore, so you can have a method and then just automatically dispatch from within it. Any block that sets dollar underscore. And that includes exception handlers. This catch is just a funny way to set dollar underscore for this block. And then it's a regular switch inside. We don't have special catch syntax like many other languages. It just naturally falls out with a little tweak. Which is, these other languages tend to put the catch outside of the block. And then you lose visibility to any of the lexical variables that were in the block. Now, I don't refer to dollar X or dollar Y here, but if I did, I could see it from inside the catch block there, which is here in a try. But the fact is, another advantage of putting it inside is that it can turn its outer block into a try block. So we don't actually need that try. It's redundant. We just write it like that. Close it up. That is still a try block. The sub is behaving as a try block because it has a catch block in it. There are many kinds of catch-like blocks that will capture control at various locations. When you're entering or leaving a block, when you're doing a next, the first time through this block, there's a keep and an undo block, which is like a leave block, except it's transactional. It knows whether the block is exiting successfully or unsuccessfully, so you can do transactional processing with it. Pre and post blocks are for design by contract, but they're all the same thing. They're all just begin blocks. And begin blocks are all just properties on the block that they are. Moving on to object orientation. We'll talk about some of these things. The syntax, rather than setting runtime variables like isa, it's still probably doing things like that underneath and running bits of code, but it looks declarative, and that's important. And the default declarations just map naturally onto your typical object-oriented vocabulary. So if you say the class, the dog is a mammal, that's how you write it. And you say, it has a tail. Has. We still use methods. That dot there allows us to auto-write our accessors for the attributes that have accessors. But you don't have to write those. So here's a complete class. You can write it either this way, if it's an entire file, or you can write a class as a block with the block notation, which is a more standard way of writing it. And they'll both mean the same thing. Though the class, if it's an inner class, it might be installed in a different place. So as I mentioned, it auto-generates not only the accessors, but also the constructor method, or defaults to a generic one that it can use. So I can say, give me a new dog with a tail and legs with a particular thing. And you don't have to write those methods. Or the corresponding init methods, which we actually call build methods. Which you can write if you want to, but you don't have to. If you just want the default. Private variables simply don't have the dot in, as a secondary sigil. We got tired of saying secondary sigil because we have a lot of them, and they're very useful for indicating weird namespaces. It's weird things should look weird is one of the principles in Perl 6, and the attributes are a little bit weird, so they look a little bit weird. The dot means that I'm auto-generating an accessor. If you leave that out, there isn't an accessor, and it's a private variable. It's lexically scoped to the class, and it can't be seen outside. And you have to use the accessors outside, and we have ways of specifying, finalizing, or not, on an application-wide basis that will hopefully make that efficient without closing or finalizing classes prematurely. Multi-methods is another important aspect, which I really don't have time to get into, but the entire Perl 6 runtime system is built on multi-methods, so you can overload any of the built-in operators with more specific types, and it'll just find your version. Delegation is supported with a natural syntax. Inner classes you all know about, don't need to talk about those. Roles are our idea about interfaces, but it's more than just interfaces. It's if any of you read the Smalltalk traits paper, it's more than just traits, but it's closely modeled on that. The idea is it's an interface with a default implementation that you can pull in at compile time, and it will figure out if there are any method collisions. Rather than we can also do runtime mix-ins. The problem with mix-ins is they overlay the previous definitions, and you can hide things and not realize it. Whereas with roles, at compile time, if you pull them in and say what roles this object fulfills, it can figure out if there's a conflict and warn you, which is good. Support not only types, but constrained subtypes. With subset notation, so we can say hex is an int where it's in 0 to 15, define odd numbers, define Japanese strings, define what a pet is. If that's not on your list, I'm sorry. You can redefine subsets of subsets. Using a role, and these are assertions that the values of this type have to fulfill the where clauses, and again that's just a smart match operator on the right. Moving on from object orientation, we have put a lot of thought into also supporting functional programming. We're supporting many different paradigms. To the extent that it's not exclusive to the other paradigms. So we can do continuations and currying and lazy lists and et cetera. Pugs is written in Haskell currently, though we'll rehost the compiler in Perl 6 really soon. And Parrot already supports continuations. That's the low-level VM. Continuations. If you know what they are, I don't need to explain them. If you don't know what they are, you don't want to know. But basically, they're like backtracking points in a regular expression, only without the regular expression. That's like the cat without the cat. And they will be hidden from mere mortals. You have to use a big uppercase thing to get at them so you know you're doing something weird. Currying is an idea from Haskell and other languages. Only we make it explicit rather than doing it implicitly. And we say, you know, if you take a function, and you can say, well, just assume that the x argument is 1. or assume that the y argument is 2, and that gives us functions with a more limited functionality, and hopefully gives the optimizer a chance to optimize some of that. Lazy lists, in Perl 6, scalars are not lazy, but lists are lazy by default, and you can tweak that. But that means the list in a for loop can be an infinite list. It doesn't have to generate all of those integers. It just runs until the loop exits. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, I mean 0, 1, 2, 3. You do fancier things if you're into PDL type programming, mapping one thing to another. Argument lists. Because we have we have argument lists and we have multiple dispatch, we can do a trick on this is pretty much a transcription of something you probably see in Audrey's Haskell talk later. This is quicksort. And basically it says, if you pass a null list, return a null list. And if it doesn't match that, then it matches a list which has a head and a tail. Partition them into a list that's greater than the head, a list that's less than the head, and return the sorted sublist with the pivot in the middle. And that's all it is. It's very powerful to be able to do this signature matching. And we also plan to have signature matching embedded in our regular expression rule engine for matching against things that are not strings, but look more like argument lists. We'll do tail recursion optimization. Now, the thing I really wanted to get to that we think will influence the world outside of Perl, we saw how everyone borrowed Perl 5 compatible regular expressions, and we figured, they're a real big mess, and we're sorry. We're changing them now, now that you just borrowed them. So everyone is going to go from PCRE to P6RE or something like that. But there's a lot of cruft that we inherited from Unix culture, and we added more cruft, and we're cleaning it up. So in Perl 5, we made the mistake of interpreting regular expressions as strings, which meant we had to do weird things like back references are backslash one on the left, but they're $1 on the right, even though it means the same thing. In Perl 6, because it's just a language, an embedded language, $1 is the back reference. It does not automatically interpolate that $1 from whatever was before. Have a way to do that. You can also use that to translate to euros, I guess. No, not really. just seeing if you're awake. In Perl 5, if you wanted to interpolate a string but didn't want it to be treated as a regular expression, you had to do this weird quote meta thing. In Perl 6, that is the default. If you interpolate a string, it matches it literally, which is why you can match the back reference, $1, literally. Same thing is true of Perl's of arrays. This is an array of literal strings that just match an alternation. Or you can look up by a longest token rule, the longest key in this hash, which matches the next bit of string. And that is used heavily in the Perl 6 parser, or will be. In Perl 5, if you put a bare variable, it treated it as a regular expression. Well, that's literal now, so we've changed the default around. So if you want something treated as a regular expression, as an embedded regular expression interpolated, then we have this new notation, which we have can interpolate a single rule or an alternation of rules, or again, look up a token key and then call out to another rule. And this allows us to build recursive grammars. In Perl 5, the problem is it was just completely irrational how the meta characters worked. Parens might or might not capture. That does grouping without capture. That calls a closure. That calls an indirect rule. The square brackets are underutilized, so are the curlies, and the angle brackets were unused, so I stole them. They are now meta characters. And we just don't have enough bracketing characters in ASCII.
Unicode.
Which is why we stole the French brackets. In Perl 6, it's very consistent. Prints, capture, brackets group, braces, call a closure. Meta syntax is always with angle brackets. Use of white space is encouraged. In fact, there is no X modif- an X anymore. That is now the default, the mandatory default. Postfix modifiers are bad because you have to go all the way to the end and then it changes the meaning of what's before, so we pulled them out to front. And we have a consistent, what we call an adverbial notation that has a colon on the front. It's basically a named argument. That colon G is a named argument to the substitution function. These trailing switches are gone. Things which are modal and change the meaning of dot and up arrow and dollar, now they have separate tokens. So if you want to match interior new lines within a string, you double the up arrow or the dollar. Dot now always matches any character. And if you want the old default meaning, then you actually say, I want to match not a new line. Lowercase n matches a new line, so uppercase n, following the pattern that we already established, matches not a character which is not a new line. White space is a default. We no longer need a switch which says interpret the right hand side as an expression, because we can interpolate expressions. As I said, everywhere these curlies mean a closure. So even in a string, this interpolates the value of that closure. And we have some new modifiers, some of which are familiar and some of which are not. Look for overlapping or exhaust all the possibilities. Pretend you're prologue, I guess. Find the third match. Do the first three matches. Do auto white space matching or don't do auto white space matching. And of course, the most important one is, I don't understand all this new stuff. Just give me the Perl 5 regular expression here. And it'll do that too. The meta syntax, instead of trying to guess what horizontal white space is, you just say /H. That's horizontal white space, including Unicode white space. And we have vertical white space, which I suppose includes vertical tab, whatever that is. Alpha. If you say A to Z and want to match alphas, it's probably wrong. For most of Europe and anywhere that is not the U.S. So now we tend to use named rules to match character classes, and this tends to free up the square brackets for other uses. So if you actually want to match a character class, then you put it in this angle brackets meta notation. So we've sort of de-Huffmanized it, or you can make it readable. The negation is doing set addition and subtraction. So this just says the set of all characters with those subtracted out. Or you can say like this. And it's a lot more readable. In Perl 5, we had this gobbledygook. You can just see that it's a lot clearer. And again, we've gotten rid of those switches, and now you can read the expression left to right and know what it means. Simplified a lot of the really crufty metasyntactic things. The null match is now illegal. This prevents a class of errors where you say A or B or C or, and then forget to put the next thing. And you suddenly it's matching the null string, you don't know why, or even worse, if the null is on the front. Also, there's this situation where if you say /, you don't know in Perl 5 whether it means match the null string or match the previous match, as in said. You have to be explicit about that now, and that actually is readable and prevents a class of errors. New line is logical new line. So if you've mounted a Windows partition on your Unix box and you say match a new line, it figures out the right thing. Assertions are now more readable, either positive or negative assertions, slightly de-Huffmanized. The backtracking control now can be applied to any preceding token the same way a quantifier can. So the brackets aren't required. The conditional syntax looks a lot less like Lisp. Here's how you match a conditional now in Perl 6. Basically, you know, if it's this, then do that. If it's this, then do that. That's how you read it. And it's, again, the colons are being a backtracking control. Only the double one says back. If you backtrack over this, backtrack out of the entire alternative set. Now, if you wrote that in Perl 5, it would have to look like this, which you can see is a lot worse. Especially all the trailing parens there. Of course, if you didn't have the X on the end there to use white space, you'd have to write it like this. And I'm sure you all agree that that's a slight improvement. But you don't even have to keep track of your captures here. You can just say, just give me the previous one. So it's a pattern, action, and each of them stands independently. Now, that's not all. We have full grammars. You want to match a floating point number. Here's a grammar for it. And it looks a lot more like Yak than it does, or BNF, than it does like regular expressions, doesn't it? That's because we have, this is now recursive. We don't even call them regular expressions anymore. We call them rules. They just build a parse tree for you. So you can using the names of these things, you can parse a number, and then you can say, well, give me the sign, and that's the sign. Give me the mantissa, the exponent. Give me the sign of the exponent, and it's all nested nicely, just as a data structure. Now. You can even use the constant subscript notation like that, and because you get tired of seeing those slashes, you can get rid of them even. I got another problem here, which is you might use digits in more than one place, and how do you differentiate them? Well, you can bind them to different names. And then after you've done that, you can just say, you see we've gotten rid of the slash there. And so you can say, well, just return the integer part of the mantissa and the fractional part of the mantissa. If you say evaluate something, that's really going to do something underneath, like, well, take the Perl 6 grammar, the top rule, and parse that thing, and compile that, and run it. A grammar is just a strange kind of class, and these rules are just funny kind of methods. And since you can override methods, why not override rules? So let's take the Perl grammar and derive a grammar from it, and we'll call it Ruby-ish. And we'll redefine identifiers to allow an optional question mark or bang on the end. And off we go, and install that as your current, with a use statement or something, and suddenly you're programming in Ruby-ish. And this is how natural languages evolve. They just make little changes to the grammar and the dictionary all the time. It's also how people learn language. You learn the simple things, and you learn other things in terms of those things. It's also how Audrey is defining pugs. I mean, he takes this syntactic sugar and desugars it into this is defined in terms of that, and that's defined in terms of that, until at the low level there's just a small number of primitives. Now we had some of this in A as just a B in Perl 5. We could say an object is just a bus reference, a class is just a package, a method is just a subroutine. Sometimes we got confused because we used the same keywords for all those things. The same thing carries over to Perl 6, though in some cases we changed the keyword, but it's still the same thing semantically underneath. So we can still do a lot of this, define one thing in terms of another. An object attribute is just a weirdly scoped variable. Class attribute. Maybe that's not true anymore. A grammar is just kind of like a class. A grammar rule is like a method. Types are properties that are just interpreted as contracts. Signatures just bind a list. Hyperoperators, you can define all these sorts of things just in terms of lower level things. Control structure is just a subroutine that can call closures. That's an important one. Okay, you've seen those. An exception handler. All control flow to exit a block is really just kind of a strange kind of exception. These things keep going. And, Perl 6. It's just a new version of Perl. And that's the talk. I guess I have gone into your break time by 5 minutes, so I don't have time for questions. But I will be here all the rest of the time, and feel free to ask me anything.